Well, buckle up.
In the old time machine.
13th century.
Texture, taste.
Very fishy.
Preservatives. Cornish pastiche.
Oh my God, never before. The themes of empire, mission, inheritance, and destiny.
Hello and welcome back to What the Food. This is the podcast that uncovers the origin story of dishes, food items, and drinks from all around the world. Old, new, popular, and the obscure. My name is Miles Dickinson. As always, I'm here with my best friends, Andy Cantor and Dom Gray. And
wow, it's our second names. Love that.
Well, yeah. We always very do first formal names, and I just thought, let's throw the second in there.
Yeah, do you want my address as well? Just fucking...
Yeah, do you help my, the stalkers out.
Do you want my PIN number for my bank account and my mum's maiden name?
All the controversial stuff that we say on there, just any of the haters will find it well easy to find us now. Cheers for that one, Miles Dickinson.
Oh, well, it's our mission to delve into the deep, dark depths of history to uncover why we eat the food that we eat. Today, we're covering the origin of ketchup.
Proper saucy one today.
A little saucy. Ooh, devil.
Bit of a tangy one.
It's one of them things, isn't it? It's just there.
Like, just always has been, always will be.
How many times have you been round to someone's house and you've been in a position where ketchup has been needed and you've asked them and they said, I don't have any? Never. Could probably count it on one hand.
It's
pretty universal.
And if they haven't got it, you can just knock on next door neighbour. They've got loads of it.
Nope.
I don't know that I'd ever do that. Maybe. Sounds a bit odd, but maybe.
What's the process there, Miles? Are you asking for the bottle or are you taking round next door the item in which you want the sauce on? What's your tactic?
I'm asking for a squirt. Could I have a squirt, please?
Tactics to take round my favourite ramekin, which is usually a glass goo pot.
Reduce, reuse, recycle.
Yeah, that's what I'm all about. I don't think I've ever asked a neighbour for ketchup before because I've always had it in.
I don't know. You're talking like a man who's siphoned ketchup before.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're speaking from experience. I would have never thought of the ramekin trick. That's a veteran ketchup statue.
I'd have probably asked him to put it in my hand before I got a ramekin.
Yeah.
Ooh.
In the palm of my hand, please.
Yeah. Oh, God.
All right, well, here's a little debate for you. Are you keeping your ketchup in the fridge or are you keeping it in the cupboard?
I'm keeping it in the fridge.
Mine's in the fridge.
I just don't want the germs to grow. I want my ketchup to last longer.
Good. I think if it was unopened, I'd maybe keep it in the cupboard.
Oh, yeah. No, it unopened. Mm. I mean, it's not in the fridge in the supermarkets, is it?
Just correct.
Just sitting there.
Before we get stuck in, I just want to do like a little quiz with you two, if that's all right. A little ketchup quiz.
That's always all right with me.
Question number one. How much revenue in dollars has ketchup generated worldwide in 2023 to date?
4.9 trillion.
Fucking hell, Dom. Trillion.
Heinz aren't going to space.
Yeah, no, but there's like Aldi's own, there's all the brands of it. We're not just it's not Heinz Monopoly anymore, boys. Just remember
that's a mad bit of marketing there that Miles immediately thought
of. Yeah, exactly.
Heinz.
All right.
So we're just saying ketchup in general.
Ketchup, yeah.
Shit,
yeah,
okay.
You little sheep. Should have let you guess before I gave you that clarification.
So what did you go for, Dom? You went in the
trillions.
No,
I'm not telling you.
Yeah, you said 3 trillion.
I'm going to say it's a $1.5 billion industry.
Okay. Miles, you are the closest because 3 trillion obviously is a mad guess.
I said 4.9, so...
It's 35.47 billion.
Whoa.
A lot of ketchup, that, isn't it?
It's a big number, but very I thought we were getting trilly.
So I'll give the point to Miles for that one. So Miles is in the lead currently.
Whatever.
Question number two. How much ketchup does a average UK Mackey's go through per year in tons?
Okay, well, I'm going to beat Milo here because I've got the inside line on this. So I'm going to picture my deliveries. They're coming in big cardboard boxes. I'm saying 450 million tons.
Just based...
No, that's wild, actually. That's actually wild. That's more than a million tons a day. Okay, no, I withdraw. I'm going to go for 27 million tons.
Oh, bro, what the fuck? Million tons, that's so much.
Dom. I thought you were going to get close based on, you know, you having worked for the establishment before.
Yeah. Okay, well, actually, I think we should have let Miles guess first this time, because the thing is, like, I set the bar last time with trillion being silly.
That is silly. Did you say in a 12-month period?
On average, per year. Correct.
Okay. I'm going to say...
Okay, so just to put it into reference, right?
I didn't get this.
Well, no, you've not guessed. An African elephant weighs 6 tons.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to say 150,000 tons.
Okay. I'm going to say that that's Loserville guess. I'm going to say 151,000 tons of ketchup.
You're both not getting a point there because you're both shit, right?
Why? I'm closest.
It's 10,000 tons.
Oh. Neither of us get a point. Neither of us get a point because we were both... 450 million. I went for to start with. Wow, okay.
It's a lot. Okay. Yeah, so they do 4,848 tons of bulk ketchup. So that's your burgers, your squirt guns, all that sort of stuff. And 4,940 tons of packaged ketchup. So that's your dip pots and your sachets. This is from the official McDonald's UK website. I got these statistics.
Okay.
Bloody hell.
Okay. So there's no point in doing question number three because Miles won. So...
No point. Neither of us got a point. Excuse me, I'm playing for the draw. Bring it back.
I dropped a huge bottle of ketchup on my foot once. Caused a severe pain to my toes. Tomatoes.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. God. We can edit that out.
Definitely. But he's going to edit it, so he's definitely not going to edit it out.
he's going to edit a laugh from somewhere else in the episode.
Yeah.
Crowd laughter.
If anything, it'll end up in like the theme song. We'll have to listen to it every fucking episode we release.
Tomatoes.
So it took you boys a while to get that, to be fair. It might have been in my poor delivery, to be fair.
I want to play for the draw though, please, Quizmaster. Making you stand by. Then neither of us get points.
Okay, question three. How many pounds of ketchup do Americans on average consume each year?
Considering that our information is out there, our names are out there, I'm not going to make a joke about the weight of Americans. I'm going to throw it over to Miles to guess first because he needed to guess first on the last one as well.
75 pounds.
74 pounds.
He's done it. He's beating you. It's 71 pounds. You little snake.
One all.
Good guess, really. Okay,
it was a very good guess. Well played, Miles. Yeah, very good.
Well played, Miles. We'll call it a draw.
So yeah, 71 pounds is about 32 kilograms. Just FYI for the British listeners.
A lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of ketchup.
Where are they putting it all?
And those big juicy tars.
Anyway, that was a bit of fun, wasn't it? We all had a giggle there.
We did.
Yeah. Let's get into it. Let's get into the thick world of ketchup. Squeeze out some history, shall we?
Ooh.
Before we get carried away with the mad kind of history of ketchup, let's just dissect this little bad boy, shall we? You know, it's a very ubiquitous product, ketchup, I feel. But have we ever had to actually kind of taken a step back and looked at what ketchup is, the ins and outs of it, texture, taste, all that sort of stuff. So taste-wise, a bit of a curious mix, I'd say. Sweet, yet tangy, with a bit of a smidgen of salt.
Tang is kind of the forefront, isn't it? It's a very tangy sauce.
Very tangy.
Vinegary.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that's why it's kind of often with meat and fried food, isn't it? Because it's that vinegariness that cuts through the richness of meat and fried food.
Yeah.
Fine.
Here's a question for you. How many times have you been caught out by that initial watery betrayal when you don't shake it?
Don't. That's upset me.
Why have you brought that up?
Because that's just got sadness written all over it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, if that gets on your food.
Like bit ketchup pre-cum. Not nice.
I was waiting for that word. I was trying to avoid it, but I knew it was coming.
Ketchup.
That's foul.
That is foul. Well, no, ketchup's when you've actually got the proper stuff coming out.
Yeah.
You know, we're all putting ketchup over everything.
Yeah.
We're catch coming all over the place. We're catch coming on our fucking hot dogs. We're catch coming on our burgers. I'm catch coming on grandma's food and all.
Whoa.
She's not got the wrist for it anymore. She needs hand.
Yeah, I'll catch come all over her.
God. Boys, come on now. Get it together.
Silliness.
Very silly. I mean, on the texture front, when you're not battling that kind of initial liquid ambush. smooth, viscous, you could say, maybe? Viscous?
Yeah, it's got a thickness to it. Yeah.
Give it a sniff. There's a certain kind of freshness to it, maybe?
No.
A viscous freshness?
No.
You never sniff your ketchup gum? Not bad.
I've never sniffed ketchup and thought, ooh, fresh.
No, it's not fresh.
I think you need to work on your verbiage.
No, it's a certain
fresh.
Yeah, it's like tomatoes. It's like tomatoes. It like smells vinegar.
Of tomatoes. The smell of a tomato is fresh.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
vinegar is a natural preservative, is it not?
It's a classic scent. Come on, like it's some a of barbecue.
Scent. It's mm-hmm. a classic scent. Yeah, classic I just scent. Don't think it's a fresh scent.
It's a classic fresh scent.
No, I'm taking
You're not getting fucking Airwick special edition ketchup flavour yeah. plugins.
Ketchcum.
Fresh ketchup. Colour-wise, obviously that signature red that we all know and love.
Mm.
Kind of a bit of an unsung hero, I think, of making food look better. I feel like it does quite a good job of making food look very aesthetically pleasing. I'd feel.
Yeah. You'd think that red, because it's the colour of blood, you'd maybe be a bit more hesitant to smother your food in this fresh sauce. But it's that
vibrant red, isn't it? It's that kind of pop colour that kind of
kicking.
Makes dishes look good.
Fresh. Good. Yeah, so I think that gives us a pretty... I mean, I'm not going to tell you how to suck eggs. Everyone's hopefully heard of ketchup.
Sorry.
But now that we've got a good grip on it, let's venture and see how it came to be, shall we? Pretty wild ride. Trust me, I wasn't expecting to go as far back as I did.
Buckle the fuck up.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Buckle up. About to swerve into the left lane of history. Here we go.
Oh, God.
Scoot, scoot.
I mean, when you think of ketchup, probably think of tomatoes, right?
I do.
Yeah, definitely.
It's called tomato ketchup.
Well, no, we're talking about ketchup. Yeah, we're not talking about tomato ketchup. Yeah, I mean, you probably think of tomatoes, but here's a kicker, mate. OG ketchup, zilch to do. With tomatoes.
What?
Nothing. So let's rewind.
Can't be right.
Let's rewind the clock all the way back to ancient Southeast Asia.
Back in the old time machine again.
Back in... The term ketchup likely comes from the Hokkien Chinese word ketsiap. Spelled
ketsiap.
K-E-T-S-I-A-P. Ketsiap.
Okay.
Ketsiap.
Ketsiap is a kind of fermented fish sauce.
Okay.
Where you get your tang from.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, yeah, like a fish sauce. Imagine smothering chips in a nice little fish sauce.
Oh, yeah, some nice sardines that have been left out in the sun to reduce down into a nice oil.
Yeah,
just a bit smother dip-ish. That. No, I wouldn't dip, I'd smother.
But, you know, the mission of a good condiment is to cut through the current dish you're eating with it. You know, it's to go with something. So fish is that ingredient that gives the power to the sauce in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. That's going to cut through that.
No, yeah, you're right. You're right.
What is it? Anchovies are in Worcester sauce, aren't they? That's kind of the key ingredient of Worcester sauce. Yeah, exactly.
Bloody hell, you learn something new every day.
Yeah, and this is very similar. This ketsiap, it's very similar to kind of like your modern day Worcester sauce, or even soy sauce, like a bit of a darker soy sauce.
Yeah.
And like, I've kind of put together a bit of a method of how they'd make this ketsiap in Southeast Asia. It involves like the fermentation of fish, often with salt, sometimes other ingredients. But in terms of like a general idea, here's how they would make it. So you grab a small fish, probably more than one.
Just any fish you can get your hands on. Just
any small fish. Grab a fish. Typically, just grab one. You want it small because you want it to break down easily. Cleaned, but typically left whole, so you're not doing any chopping business.
You're leaving the guts in.
Leaving everything in.
Oh, God, I don't know. I don't know if I like ketchup anymore.
No.
This is like Schmeagle sauce.
Yeah.
Schmeagle's favourite sauce.
It's literally going to, that means it's going to have poo in.
Yeah.
Well,
is what it means.
Yeah.
Unless they're squeezing the fish to kind of make it poo before they...
It's not a thing, Dom.
Is it like you could just grab it by its head and like toothpaste?
It's not a toothpaste tube, lad, no. They probably do gut them. It makes sense to gut them. Yeah. But they're left whole, like eyes and scales and all that shit intact.
Oh, I don't mind a little eye.
Yeah, exactly. The fish are then heavily salted, and the salt acted as kind of not only as a preservative, but also kind of played a key role in like the fermentation process. You then do some layering. So like you're making a tiramisu, but instead of sponge fingers and mascarpone, you're using fish and salt. So you've layered the fish, you leave it out in the sun for several months.
Okay.
Right.
The fish ferments. Months. And it breaks down into a slurry.
Great word.
After the fermentation was complete, the liquid is then pressed and drained off. This liquid is essentially the fish sauce. It's kind of like a clear amber liquid with a strong fishy aroma. funnily enough, and a kind of a deeply salty, like umami taste. You can refine it a bit further if you want to. If you want to go kind of all artisan with it, you can boil it down and continue to refine it to concentrate the flavors, produce kind of a bit of a clearer product, or you can just eat it ready to go. So that's like a basic katsuyo. And the basic one is obviously just fish and salt, but you can also get ones or variations of ones that have like soybeans, some grains, some spices, kind of things like that to either assist the flavor or assist the fermentation as well. Yeah. So, okay. I mean, this sauce was like prize. It's like, you know, its ability to add like depth and umami to kind of any dish was prized, obviously.
So kind of sprinkling it over things and just having it alongside.
Yeah, exactly. Or stirring it through things to like enhance and bring out the flavors of the dish. Kind of like how you'd use fish sauce now, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, obviously, with anything kind of during the ancient times, this kind of fishy brew made its way along all the trade routes, getting a few makeovers along the way. So Southeast Asia, you've obviously got Indonesia, where it became Kit Kat. Malaysia, where it became Kit Kat. And
UK, where it became Kit Kat.
You still got it. You still got it.
Oh, God, he's here. He's turned up tonight, isn't he?
And here, he's back. He's,
yeah, and basically every place that it landed essentially took on new characteristics. Dash of this, sprinkle of that. Everyone kind of wanted to get in on the Kitsiap game. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any of these super early references to it. The earliest references I could find were from like European explorers who found it. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just Southeast Asian kind of sources haven't been translated, or they're not online.
Yeah, maybe that's a reason why, you know, because it's just kind of, there's no set way to do it. Everyone's got their own kind of local ingredients that end up going in there.
No, for sure. It's also a ball ache to make. Someone isn't going off and making this by themselves for themselves. They'll go off and make it for the village, town, to sell, to give to family, whatever. Because it takes like a big batch several of months. Yeah, exactly. You're not making like a single serving of katsuyop. But yeah, so our kind of understanding of these historical food products comes from either linguistic traces, archaeological evidence, or kind of indirect historical accounts. So the European travellers and kind of merchants who encountered these sources during the 17th and 18th century wrote about them. The source first appeared in 1690 in a book called A New Dictionary of Terms Ancient and Modern of the Canting Crew.
That's a mouthful of a book.
No.
Cool name for a book, though. A New Dictionary of the Terms Ancient and Modern of the Canting Crew. I'm guessing the Canting Crew were like some European travellers or merchants who were just cutting about the place.
Learning all these new words and writing them down, bringing them back.
I feel like if we were a canting crew, it's almost a canter crew. That's pretty cool. That could be us boys just dotting about in 1690, just cutting into Southeast Asia.
Tasting new foods and writing down words that we learn.
The fuck's this red sauce?
The fuck is this red sauce? It's very fishy.
Very fishy.
But yeah, so that's a book in 1690 in which ketchup is described as High East India sauce.
Ooh.
High East India sauce.
Yeah, it's quite cool, isn't it? Oh. High East India sauce. Kind of cool. Personally prefer it. Imagine calling your ketchup High East India sauce. Way better.
Yeah.
So that's in 1690. Later on in 1711, the first known mention of ketchup appears, actual ketchup, the word, appears in print in the British merchant Charles Lockyer's An Account of the Trade in India, in which he wrote that the best ketchup can be found in Tonquin, which is present-day Tonkin in northern Vietnam.
Whoa. Typical of British people to just like ignore the pronunciation of something and just change it to make it easier for us to say it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
We just can't be bothered putting the effort into saying something with the accent it's supposed to be said in.
Bad behaviour, innit?
I'll just change it completely.
Because you're saying there that in that previous book in the 1600s, it was still its old name, wasn't it? And then you jump to the 1700s and it's this British guy's just calling it ketchup. Lazy man.
Taking the piss.
Lazy boy.
Yeah, lazy boys. So yeah, when ketchup made its way from Southeast Asia over to England in the 18th century with kind of all these merchants and travellers bringing it back, it underwent, as most things do, a culinary makeover that was both kind of inventive and distinctively British. So the essence of the sauce's kind of transformation is best described as a shift from its fishy origin to the earthy flavours of the English countryside.
Wow.
So here's how that transformation occurred. So the term ketchup or catsup is a very common word for it. Catsup, C-A-T-S-U-P.
I was going to say, I feel like I even see that nowadays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people do call it that.
I'm sure I've seen it on my travels.
No.
Was it ketchup manis or whatever it's called? Ketchup manis. Have you heard of that? It's like a Thai tomato-y ketchup-y sauce.
I can't say I have, mate.
I've heard of it, mate.
Yeah. Look out for it. Catch it's usually it. In like the Asian section of the supermarket, like a dark, almost like a dark oyster sauce that you can use to flavor sauces and stuff. But it's, I think it's called like ketsap something.
Ketsap.
So it's kind of reminding me. Might be
interesting. Related.
What to do with this?
But yeah, I mean, in England, the kind of the name of the sauce was kind of either ketchup, modern way, or catsup, spelled that way. And kind of the recipe was molded to fit local tastes and ingredients. The fish was largely ditched. And new main ingredients emerged, such as mushrooms, walnuts, and oysters.
Mushrooms?
Ooh.
Mushrooms. Yeah, so walnut. Essentially, you're after anything that's like umami, really, to replace fermented fish. Because the idea of Britain's fermenting fish is not high up there,
yeah.
I don't think.
not great.
No.
And obviously, we have a plethora of mushrooms in this country, so finding a new way to use a big bulk of leftover mushrooms and consolidate those down into a nice, like you said, umami-rich sauce.
Yeah, and it's very much, big fans of mushrooms, aren't we? Lots of mushrooms everywhere. And mushroom ketchup became the most popular. You know, England with its damp climate is a haven for wild mushrooms, both psychedelic and non-psychedelic.
Are you telling me that there's some ancient recipes for mushroom ketchup that could get us absolutely schlonkoed?
I would say so. Yeah, probably out there. Yeah.
Wow. Proper killer hot dog.
Yeah, some peasant farmers in Tunbridge Wells have probably come up with a lovely, trippy,
lovely condiment.
Yeah.
Tunbridge Wells. Christ.
Tunbridge trippy ketchup. Come on down.
Trippy ketchup.
Tunbridge trippy ketchup.
If it ever.
Trippy chup.
Trippy chup.
Tunbridge trippy chup.
Trippy chup.
Chup get your Tunbridge trippy chup.
Tunbridge trippy chup.
Tunbridge trippy chup. If it ever becomes legal like it is in Amsterdam, we're starting a ketchup business and we're making psychedelic ketchup called Trippy Trup.
Yeah, everybody just forget that you've just heard this little brainstorm and we're doing it, not you.
We'll get the business plan made and we'll get it over to HSBC immediately.
Forget about it.
Forget about it. But yeah, when we come to make our Trippy Trup, you essentially have to take the mushrooms, salt them, crush them down, leave them to ferment for several days. And again, you're left with a lovely slurry. And what you
Great
do with that lovely
word.
Slurry.
Slurry.
With seasonings like cloves, ginger, and sometimes even a bit of port wine if you're feeling.
Whoa.
If you're feeling Lugy. Fruity.
Go on.
After cooking it, you give it a good old strain and you're left with a dark, flavour packed liquid that was mushroom ketchup.
Wow.
Ketchup.
Bloody hell.
Mad.
Can you get mushroom ketchup today anywhere? It's not something that you see often.
I've never seen it, but you probably can. There'll be some artisan somewhere trying to convince people that it's better than tomato ketchup.
Like artisan might be generous a word to describe this. Weirdo might be more apt. I don't know that I'd be impressed. I wouldn't be impressed if you came up to me and you said, here's some of my mushroom ketchup. I'd say get a life.
Okay, would you be more impressed? Here's some of my mushroom ketchup, which I've grown from mushrooms from my mushroom farm.
I would still say use them for other things because you're barking up the wrong tree here, love.
Well, we're talking about fermented though as well. I'm all down for a mushroom sauce, a creamy, truffly, delicious mushroom sauce. But
a fresh sauce, if you will.
A fresh sauce. We're talking here about concentrated, fermented, slurried, gooey, concentrated sauce. Not sure.
Yeah.
But not going to knock it until I try it.
We need to work the word slurry into the title of this episode. It just
it's key. By the mid 18th century, ketchup has firmly established itself in the footing in English culinary circles. As Justin Cord Hayes points out, the term ketchup has become synonymous with any kind of spiced sauce you can find accompanying your meal. And kind of England's flourishing trade with its kind of far-flung colonies meant that spices like cinnamon, mustard seeds, nutmeg, cayenne pepper were kind of never too far for the cook's grasp. And essentially they were adding all of these different spices to the ketchup, kind of give
it's
it
starting to get a bit fancy.
A bit fancy, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Starting to
get
a bit out of hand even.
Yeah, because it's just a blank canvas, really. Bit of a blank canvas.
Yeah.
A bit out of hand.
We're getting out of hand. Can everybody stop making bloody ketchup?
Fucking hell,
everywhere
lad.
Go. But I mean, with English cuisine, you know, and especially English cuisine in the past, people say it's a bland cuisine and it might have been blander in history. So people were obviously relishing at the idea of making a sauce that, you know, can improve the blandness of the typically British cuisine.
Yeah, no, definitely. And this was like the age of seasoning because, you know, all these far-flung places were delivering mad spices that we'd never seen before and we were testing different things out.
Yeah.
And ketchup was just the poster child for it, really.
Wow.
Yeah.
There you have
and
it.
You can put as little or as much as you want of it on your current dish. So if it's a new ingredient that's come from overseas that you've never had before, you don't have to commit fully to it, you know, sort of bake it into the entire dish. You can create a sauce with it and have a couple of little dabs and see if you like saffron flavoured
tarragon
sauce.
Tarragon ketchup. Very nice. And yeah, the culinary chronicles of the time bear witness to ketchup's soaring fame.
Ooh.
Yeah, so take, for instance, Eliza Smith's 1758 magnum opus, The Complete Housewife. In The Complete Housewife, she features a pioneering recipe for English ketchup, spelled K-A-T-C-H-U-P. Far from the tomatoey blend, which we kind of douse our chips in nowadays, this concoction was a medley of anchovies, cloves, ginger, and pepper designed to pep up fish sauces and meat dishes alike.
Ooh, okay.
This is the recipe as follows.
Take a wide-mouthed bottle, put therein a pint of the best white vinegar, then put in 10 or 12 cloves of echalot, peeled and just bruised. Then take a quarter of a pint of the best lagoon white wine, boil it a little, and put it to 12 or 14 anchovies, washed and shred, and dissolve them in the wine. And when cold, put them in the bottle. Then take a quarter of a pint more of white wine, and put it in a mace, ginger sliced, a few cloves, a spoonful of whole pepper, just bruised. Let them boil a little. When they're cold, slice in almost a whole nutmeg and some lemon peel. A little put in. And likewise. put in 3 spoonfuls of horseradish. Then stop it close and for a week shake it once or twice a day. Then use it. 'Tis good to put into fish sauce. Or any savoury dish of meat, you can add it to the clear liquor that comes from mushrooms.
That was amazing. Oh, yeah. Dialed in for that. Wow.
Yeah, I was there. I was with her.
Eliza's on one with that.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of bruised shit going in that sauce.
She's bruising all sorts.
She's beating it up. She's giving it a hard
12
time.
12 echalots peeled and just bruised. Mm. A whole spoonful of pepper, just bruised. And she's also using a lot of wine. Like, yeah,
it's a bit of a boozy one.
She is a bit of a boozy one. Mm. She's
no wonder she enjoys it so much.
Right.
Yeah.
But it seems fairly straightforward, doesn't it? You're just adding loads of shit to a pan and boiling it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems a lot better than the 7 month
fish
write it down sort of job.
No,
slurrying. There was a distinct lot of slurry there, though.
Mm. Although Eliza Smith has written this book, you know, The Complete Housewife, and I would have to say, if you know, living back then, if Eliza was my wife, and I'd come home from a difficult day working working in the firehouse, I'd be a bit pissed off if she'd been faffing around with loads of wine and fishes in the house.
Well, what if it was tasty, mate?
Making a
would
bit
you
of
be
mess
pissed off
with
then?
All that crap.
You're sounding rather misogynistic right now, Miles.
Making a lot of mess with a lot of crap.
Yeah, she's cooked you up a lovely sauce.
Expressing herself from no point at all.
Yeah. Wasted energy. I'm out there saving lives.
She's not allowed to work. She's like, society's, you know, not allowing her to have the same rights as men. And I don't even want her to be able to express herself in the kitchen either.
No.
There you go.
Put down.
Just remember, full name, Miles Dickinson.
Yeah, I kind of regret saying that. I think she should be able to experiment with her wine and her echelons as much as she wants to.
No, it's all right. We're going to move on.
It's on record. It's on record. We all heard you.
Move on, quick.
You're going to be in a slurry of trouble there, mate.
I need to fash. That's the title of the episode. Ketchup, a slurry of trouble.
That's it.
Write it down.
Spot on. Slurry of trouble. Yeah, brilliant. Cool. So let's flash forward to the 1800s, and essentially homemade ketchups were all the rage, probably thanks to women expressing themselves up and down the country. No thanks to Miles. But yeah, a spectrum of flavors graced the dining room tables. You know, you got zesty lemon, robust walnut, and yeah, all sorts essentially. And you also have another influential book that comes around this time, I think 1861. Mm-hmm. You've got Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management.
Yeah. bit shorter than the last one, which I appreciate.
Bit shorter, bit snappier.
Do appreciate, yeah.
Of household management.
Of household management, and it contains things...
Eliza could have done with that. sorry, God. carry on.
Absolutely trouble.
Yeah, it's a good book. I managed to find it on Google Books, obviously didn't buy it, and it catalogues an array of ketchups, placing special emphasis on the likes of oyster and the mushroom variants. So I wanted to highlight how you make an oyster ketchup, just because we've not had that yet. So this is Mrs. Beaton's oyster ketchup recipe.
Procure the oysters very fresh and open sufficient to fill a pint measure. Save the liquor and scald the oysters in it with the sherry. Strain the oysters and put them in a mortar with the salt, cayenne and mace. Pound the whole until reduced to a pulp. Then add it to the liquor in which they were scalded. Boil it again for 5 minutes and skim well. Rub the whole through a sieve and when cold, bottle and cork closely. The corks should be sealed.
Doesn't sound that great, that one, does it?
No, one sounds a bit more chaotic. I have to say, Mrs. Beaston might be Mr. Beaston.
Yeah.
Judging by her voice.
She didn't get a voice, but...
She was a bassline, sick bassline.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't take on Mrs. Beaston.
Oh, it's all right. Probably because she's a woman.
Yeah, because she'd fucking manage you out of the household, that's why.
She would. So what she's saying there, then, she's preparing the oysters and she's kind of scalding them, so like getting a bit of caramelization on them. I'm guessing she's like kind of frying them to get a bit of flavor in there. Then she's kind of almost like deglazing with sherry, and then she's straining the oysters. She's putting them in a mortar and pestle with salt and cayenne pepper, pounding the shit out of these fried oysters into a pulp. Then she's adding some more liquor. Just liquor, whatever.
No, the liquor from the first bit. Look, save the liquor.
Oh, save the liquor. Yeah, she's saving that liquid. So you add that liquid back in, boil it again for 5 minutes and skim well, get rid of the phlegm on the top, and then sieve the whole lot and put it into a bottle and cork it. Wow, that's sounding really, really dutty.
And then down it in one.
the amount of work that goes into what we just consider like a bit of ketchup,
condiment.
Just a bit of a throwaway thing, innit? I just do a little bit of a squirt on there, don't even think about it. There's a bit of work that goes into that.
Big old bit of work. I think like as we take this kind of journey from, you know, ancient kind of Southeast Asia to kind of English kitchens, clear that kind of while the core of ketchup, you know, it's a flavour enhancer, has remained consistent. Like the ingredients kind of dance to like the local taste and availability of ingredients. Kind of like switched it up, whether it's kind of fish, mushrooms or tomatoes. Ketchup has always been about like elevating the dishes it accompanies. Yeah, so I thought it was pretty interesting. But
always the bridesmaid, never the bride, you might say.
Wow.
Yeah.
Never going to have a bowl of ketchup, are you?
Now, anyway, hold on to your lids, boys. Shit's about to get real. Tomatoes have arrived.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Mighty tomato. A fruit or is it a veg?
It's a fruit, isn't it? It's got seeds, it's a fruit, lad. Yeah. It's got seeds. It's a fruit. Come on.
But yeah, I mean, the tomato, I think we've covered this in a pizza episode, but the tomato took a very long time to be fully embraced by European cuisine.
Yeah, it's a bit big, isn't it? Part of like a poisonous family something.
They thought for a long time, didn't they, that they were poisonous?
Looks it, to be fair. Bright red, slimy on the inside.
No, you're right.
You know?
Yeah, so although the tomato originated in the Americas, it took a rather kind of long-ass route to become a staple in Europe. It took a very long and windy journey. Yeah, exactly. A really good kind of quote that we've got to summarize this is from Andrew F. Smith in his book, The Tomato in America.
Knowledge of the tomato came to England by way of Spain in the mid-16th century. By the mid-18th century, it was cultivated by some gardeners in England for its fruit, which was, however, eaten only by those who were adventurous. It was still a rare garden plant regarded as an ornamental curiosity in the rest of Europe.
Cheers, Andy. Yeah, it was really...
I didn't know that Alan from last week from the Cornish Pasty Association was going to come and speak, but cheers for coming down, Alan.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, so some people were still just having it kind of like as an ornamental thing in their garden that just kind of looked interesting. Not everyone was kind of...
It's quite an iconic plant, isn't it, a tomato plant? They look quite cool, you know?
Yeah, very cool. And like at the time, it'd fucking, if you saw it for the first time, it would absolutely blow your mind, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you could show that one off. You could show that one off.
But yeah, people didn't want to eat it. They thought it was poisonous due to its relation to the deadly nightshade family.
That's it.
They were viewed with suspicion, if not terror.
Well,
they were even nicknamed poison apples.
But then I don't understand why they kind of built this massive reputation of being poisonous, because surely just like as soon as someone eats one, they're just going to be like, guys, stop it. It's fine. It's really good.
Yeah, but then you know what they'd say. He's a witch.
Yeah, you're the devil.
Nobody wanted to risk it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's why they didn't do it.
Yeah, peer pressure was pretty intense about them.
Yeah. No, exactly.
And that's fair.
People were sheep. They went with the crowd because they were going to die.
That's before information kind of passed along in the same way it does nowadays. Like people were told that it was poisonous and you just kind of believed it and didn't take the risk, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
You couldn't just Google it.
Yeah, no, you couldn't. Well, that was kind of very much the case until an American horticulturist and scientist by the name of James Mees came into play. Now, James Mees is first credited with penning the first tomato ketchup recipe in 1812. Obviously, there was loads of other people that kind of did work on tomatoes specifically, but with this being a ketchup recipe, we're just going to focus on Mr. James Mees. And his recipe bypassed the fish and fungi of the yesteryears, instead embracing the acidic goodness of tomatoes. Yeah, as noted by Andrew Smith back in his book. So not only has Andrew Smith wrote a book called The Tomato in America, he's also wrote a follow-up book called Pure Ketchup.
Oh, now there's the title.
He's such a niche scholar.
Well, niche. But he loves it. He just loves it. And this is what Andrew Smith had to say.
Mees's recipe had the rich red colour, viscosity, and acidic bite that modern ketchup consumers would find familiar.
Exactly. So we're getting to it,
So Mees is, when he says Mees's recipe, it's that guy's recipe.
James Mees, exactly, yeah.
James Mees. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, he's saying that guy's recipe had the rich red colour and viscosity and acidic bite that modern ketchup consumers would find familiar.
Yeah,
exactly right.
This is the good stuff now. None of this mushroom, none of this fishiness.
None of this slurry nonsense.
Yeah, none of that. Did they have to make a modern slurry when they're making normal ketchup, or was that out the window?
Probably.
I think that's a bit out the window now.
Okay.
Well, it would be a slurry based on like the shit that they put in it, preservatives and stuff, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe it's a modern slurry.
But yeah, I mean, hundreds of tomato ketchup recipes would follow, kind of James Mees's. An 1817 recipe incorporated both tomatoes and anchovies. It's kind of a bit of a homage to the roots of a fish sauce.
Mm. Yeah.
And then came along a bloke called Henry J. Hines.
I know that one.
What? Yeah. Yeah, as Miles kind of showed earlier, alluded to earlier, you know, synonymous with ketchup today.
Brainwash.
My mind went straight to it, didn't it?
No, you're right. And even Nancy Heinonen, who wrote an article for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, said that Heinz didn't invent ketchup, he just perfected it.
She's not wrong.
So Mr. Heinz is now on the scene. He's well and truly on the scene. So in 1876, he and L. Clarence Noble introduced their tomato ketchup to the market using a recipe that reduced the need for preservatives. Heinz's ketchup won hearts with its pure tomato taste and lack of harmful additives.
Oh, so maybe we're giving him grief for now.
Giving him grief for now, boys. You took that in stroke straight away.
Hey, well.
And this is in America.
This is in America, yeah. So like before kind of Heinz came along with his recipes and before kind of proper food regulation, ketchup manufacturers just used like fucking harmful as shit chemicals as preservatives. So they'd use like sodium benzonate was a common one, which obviously
isn't great.
Doesn't sound good at all. Some would use, like to achieve like the desired thickness, would use either too many tomatoes or they'd use fillers like pumpkin, apple, or there was even some reports of chalk being used to improve the thickness.
What? Come on. Oh God. You can't be getting that.
Can't be chalk in sauce. I was going to say about the Heinz name, because it does, you know, it doesn't sound like an American name. It kind of, with the Z feels like it's quite Germanic.
Yeah,
I don't know if his heritage is
a little bit
over this way. I don't know.
Immigrant.
Well, I mean, they all are over there, aren't they?
Well, yeah, that is it. That's it. There's not many real Americans.
Not left.
Did a number on them, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. But I think Hines himself was born in America. His dad, who was also called... So it's Henry J. Hines. And I think the J stands for John. John Hines. And his dad was called John Henry Hines, which is pretty jokes.
Mm.
And his mum was called Anna Margaretha Schmidt, also a joke's name.
Schmidt.
Schmidt. And I think they were also born in America, and it was Hines's grandfather, who was German.
Okay.
Yeah.
We looked that.
A place called like Palatine in Germany.
Okay.
So yeah, you're right. They are German.
Yeah.
There we go.
One of them.
Yeah, so they're essentially using some horrible shit in their ketchup. And again, back to Mr. Andrew Smith in his book, Pure Ketchup Notes.
Many ketchups were adulterated with harmful ingredients. Sodium benzoate, in particular, was widely used preservative that the US government later determined to be potentially harmful.
You know, if it's potentially harmful, it was very harmful. Because like they wouldn't admit that it's... harmful. Potentially harmful unless it really could do some damage, I would say.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Right, so they're just putting loads of crap in it then back then. This is before Heinz kind of came along and provided this alternative, cleaner version of ketchup.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's classified as safe, but you have to have like a certain limit in whatever dish you're making. And I think the limit was like, about the time, like 10 times the amount, linked to like ADHD and hyperactivity. Yeah, things like that. So you don't want to be in it if you can help it, essentially.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Rather not.
But Mr. Hines didn't have any of that. He was a stickler for quality and was determined to find a better way than using kind of all this preservatives and shit. Yeah, he believed that you didn't need to use it. There was a ketchup manufacturing way or making way that you could do, that you could carry out without the use of any of these harmful additives. Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley, great name.
Yeah, good name that. Strong.
Yeah, strong name. Like three powerful names in a row.
Yeah.
Harvey Washington Wiley.
Yeah.
Or Willie.
Ooh. Ooh.
Willie to his friends, maybe.
Yeah, I'd say if you know him, you can call him dead. Yeah.
So he was a famed chemist and advocate for pure food regulations, and he once said,
Hines' decision to make ketchup without preservatives was revolutionary. His process utilized ripe tomatoes and a balance of sweetness from sugar and tartness from vinegar, creating a hostile environment for spoilage bacteria.
We love that.
Right. So you're kind of getting some natural protection and preservative from the vinegar.
From the vinegar.
He's doing it in a non-harmful way.
Yeah, in essence, Hines just increased the vinegar content. So he increased that content, which essentially acted as a natural preservative. And he used ripe tomatoes, which also provided the necessary acidity. So it was like a bit of a combo.
Ah.
And this combo not only eliminated the need for chemical preservatives, but also produced a ketchup with a balanced taste. Neither sweet nor tart.
Mm, just right.
Just right.
Goldilocks ketchup, if you will.
Yeah. Beyond the recipe itself, though, Hines's choice of packaging played a role in preserving the freshness of his ketchup. In 1882, Henry J. Hines began patenting what would become the famous ketchup bottle.
Yeah, glass bottle, glass. Eh?
Significant move at the time.
Why? What were they in before that? What were they keeping it in? A little fabric pouch.
Drippy pouch.
Drippy pouch.
A pig's bladder.
Drippy raccoon pouch. A see-through beaver belt.
I wonder what they were. I wonder if it was plastic at that point.
I don't think it was plastic.
Didn't have plastic then. It probably like wood, maybe like a little wooden jar.
Yeah, or maybe like a hollowed out moose antler.
Maybe. That's a lot of meese to be killing them, isn't it?
Metal could be in like a little aluminium.
Little tin pot.
Yeah, copper pot maybe.
Ooh.
So they've come along and they've kind of revolutionized the packaging side of it with this glass bottle.
Yeah, they have. Very significant move. Obviously, not just for aesthetic purposes, but also for transparency.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
Let them see
customers,
what they're dealing with.
Yeah, customers could literally see their product they were buying. It wasn't in a tin.
We've got nothing to hide.
Nothing to hide.
And a pop in colour.
And a pop in colour. And the glass itself helped maintain the freshness as well.
I guess also glass is quite sterile, isn't it? Going back to that preservative thing and not having it spoil. Glass is, when it's steamed, it's nice and clean.
If it was wood before, wood's porous, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let things in.
Yeah. Bark in your ketchup. Don't bark in your ketchup, do you either?
Nobody wants bark in their ketchup, no.
Yeah, so very interesting move and a very kind of calculated move as well. So back to Nancy in her article in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. She highlights that Heinz's insistence on transparency, both in ingredients and in packaging, played a role in building trust with consumers. And Heinz's tomato ketchup was advertised as...
blessed relief for mother and the other women in the household.
Pretty wild that. I've read that a few times. Blessed relief for mother and the other women in the household. I think it alludes to the lengthy process that it takes to produce tomato ketchup at home.
Or maybe it's like you can just make bland food and then spice it up with my sauce, you know? You don't have to spend ages making your lovely food. Just make crap food and have this. Yeah, you know?
Yeah, maybe. Just throw something together and as long as it's got ketchup with it, it's palatable for the whole family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the Miles Dickinson school of thought. Don't enjoy yourself cooking. No, sir. You woman. Sit at home and make bland food and don't dare try and be adventurous.
That isn't my outlook on women.
That's on his gravestone, that.
Yeah.
Or yeah, it could be either of those, to be honest. It's a massive faff to make ketchup from scratch, so it's relief from that. Mm. Or it's kind of just relief from the stress of having to cook something delicious.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. But needless to say, Heinz is killing it. And by 1908, just over a quarter of a century after they started kind of selling on the market, sales of Heinz ketchup reached $2.5 million.
Wow,
let's go. Can imagine, 1908, unprecedented.
Yeah, add inflation to that. We're loving it.
No, you some big boy dollars. And additionally, Heinz deliberately chose the spelling of ketchup, spelt the K-E-T way, for his product as a way to stand out from most of his competitors who preferred the word catsup.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dare to be different, we have Heinz, as they say.
Yeah, we have Heinz really to thank for the way that we spell it nowadays.
Wow.
Because if it was to the other people, it wouldn't be that.
Icon.
Yeah.
Absolute bloody icon.
Yeah, and by the kind of like the 20th century, we see ketchup kind of firmly take its place in the culinary world. It wasn't just a sauce anymore. It was kind of the main event, you know? It was a condiment that people reached for. Like you said, it enhanced every meal easily, especially at the time. You know, you're not, sriracha isn't knocking about, hot sauce isn't really knocking about. You're dealing with very lack of condiments, especially like post-war as well, or like during the war. It's not going to be great.
Yeah.
This is a quote that we have from Ian Anderson in a book called Everyone Eats, which kind of sums it up quite well.
By the late 19th century, tomato ketchup was the main type of ketchup in the United States, and the descriptor of tomato was gradually dropped. Cookbooks and restaurants assumed that when ketchup was referred to, it was tomato ketchup. Yeah, so...
wow, it's becoming synonymous.
Exactly.
I like it.
So we drop in the whole, you know, mushroom ketchup is not a thing anymore. Oyster ketchup is not a thing anymore. It's just ketchup. And she appeared earlier to give a little quote, but we also have a lovely quote from Julia Child, a famous chef, of course, and she once commented this on ketchup and its universal appeal.
Ketchup is a splendid sauce, liked by all from childhood to old age.
No... that wasn't Julia Child.
She's become a little goblin.
Little fucking
the years,
wicked witch.
The years have not been kind to her there.
Did I do Julia before?
You nailed Julia before.
No, was Julia really nice?
Really posh and nice, yeah.
I'll have to do her again. Got to have some consistency.
Go on.
Ketchup is a splendid sauce, liked by all from childhood to old age.
Much better, Julia.
There we go.
Nice to see you. Thanks, yourself. Julia. You've had your Snickers. You're back to yourself.
Yeah, didn't know what happened. Julia was possessed for a second.
She loves it, Julia.
She loves it.
She loves it in all forms. As we sail into the 20th and 21st century, ketchup has firmly kind of established its place in the hearts, minds, and refrigerators of people around the globe. It's not all plain sailing. There have been controversies. There's always a moment in an episode where Sean Connery comes out to play.
He does. He makes at least one appearance.
Every episode. He just comes out to play, and he just it's just a controversy.
Says hello.
There's been controversies, there's been innovations, and a ketchup war that nearly divided a nation. Let's get into it. Little saucy details of the modern world of ketchup, shall we? So ketchup's dominance in the condiment world is unarguable. Places there. From fast food joints to family kitchens, practically everywhere. But it's not just the classic tomato version getting all the love. You've got more variations in the culinary world than ever. You know, we've seen sriracha ketchup. We've seen mango ketchup. We've seen black cherry ketchup. Which I didn't know was a thing. It's adaptable. You can use all sorts of kind of spices and all sorts of other condiments, add them to ketchup. You get a new sauce. Mayo ketchup, special sauce.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bit of paprika, mayo, ketchup, seafood sauce.
Yeah.
Endless ketchup.
It's everywhere. it's not just like a sauce in its own right. It's like also an ingredient that can go into other sauces.
Yeah, a bit of a base, just like, if you will.
Just kind of testament to its adaptability. It's kind of...
Oof. Adaptability. Yeah. That ties in perfectly with this lovely quote that we've got from the man himself, Gordo Ramsay.
Big man.
Right, listen up. Ketchup's adaptability is a secret weapon, okay? It's managed to stay relevant, okay? By evolving with our palates, okay?
A little clap in there as well.
Come on.
Oh, jeez, that was good. Cheers, Gordo. Love that. But it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows for ketchup. In 2016, Canada found itself in the midst of a ketchup kerfuffle.
God.
Canada always gets itself into
trouble. Yeah, it does seem
to. We've been to Canada a few times on this podcast, and it's been having some arguments or people falling out. And
No. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
It's just so cold. They're just all fucking pissed off all the time.
Yeah. Getting ugly.
I'd be that annoyed if there was that many French people knocking about. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, lad. Yes. So true, mate. I say true.
Yeah, cold and French.
Ugh. Oh, God. Ugh. Nothing worse. Oh, God. God.
Many years ago, Heinz decided it didn't want to pay Canadian farmers and Canadian factory workers a living wage. Big agro and right-wing politicians had enabled them to save a lot of money by exploiting Americans. So when they announced that they would be shutting down Canadian facilities and moving operations to the US, Canadians were not so happy about it, as you can imagine.
No.
So
big industry moving, isn't it?
Taking out jobs.
A lot of work.
Massive.
Taking out jobs.
Massive.
Yeah.
So... competitor of Heinz, French's. Slandering.
French's is the mustard men. Yellow mustard.
That is one of their condiments.
Oh, I think that's what they're most well known for, is it not?
Well, when Heinz chose to not pay Canadians for their work and move their facility to the US, French's began a PR campaign talking about how their ketchup was made with Canadian-grown tomatoes by Canadian employees and how their profit margins weren't as fat, but it was more important to support Canadians.
Can tomatoes grow in Canada? It's cold and shit there.
You can grow a tomato in England, so you can
grow boiling here, mate. It's Costa del Sol. Climate change.
There's warm spots in Canada, isn't there?
And you just use one of them for tunnels.
I know what you mean.
Greenhouse.
Yeah, greenhouse.
Is that what you mean by tunnels?
Yeah.
Nah, they're called tunnels, aren't they? They're called...
The plasticky ones. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, tunnels. Yeah. Tunnels. Maybe not tunnels.
If there's any herbologists listening, dial in and tell us what there's...
Herbologists?
Are they not called like polytunnels?
Yeah, maybe? I think so.
Well...
Look at that. I didn't even Google that straight off the top of my dome.
Yes.
Even ChatGPT that.
Hands are here.
So Frenchies have kind of swooped in and been like, look, we're not going to make as much money on ours, but we're going to make it with the Canadian ingredients, and we're going to support Canadian workers.
No, exactly. Right. They saw the gap and they went for it.
Love that.
And kind of soon, the previously kind of almost unheard of French's at the time, French's ketchup at the time, was outselling Heinz 3-1.
Oh, big win.
Taking a big slice of that market.
Yeah. And Heinz then announced, obviously, missing out on all of this sales, shit them up a little bit, that they'd changed their minds and would be reopening their Canadian operations.
The old chestnut.
But it was too late. Before they closed, they were close to around 100% of the market share for ketchup sold in Canada. Now, they're around 50%.
Wow. Once burned.
So they lost.
Shot themselves in the foot.
Massively. Well, they tried to do what was right for the profit margin rather than what was the right thing to do.
That's how you get yourself in trouble.
but then wanted to backtrack, you know, like as soon as it worked for them and they thought that they were going to increase profits by reintroducing themselves to that market, that's when they turned up. The ship has already sailed, Heinz.
Yeah.
Capitalism, mate. Capitalism.
Yeah.
Just to finish on the kind of the Canadian ketchup war, we have some nice words from food historian Ian Mosby, who had this to say on the matter.
The Canadian ketchup war was about more than just taste. It was about supporting local farmers and making a statement.
Shout out. Canadians.
Shout out.
Not the French ones.
Nah, definitely not them.
I like them all.
No.
Yeah.
They're lovely folk.
Very cool accent.
They're lovely folk.
Food. Yeah.
They're good, eh?
It's a bit average, but
they're good, eh?
Good, eh? Cool. So in terms of innovation, earlier we were talking about pre-catch-cum, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
We've all been betrayed by that first squirt of watery ketchup, yeah. Right?
Hateful moment.
Well, in 2019, a group of students from MIT tackled this age-old problem.
I got stung by it about a week ago, so they didn't.
What ketchup were you using?
It was Heinz, mate.
They've not rolled it out to Heinz yet. Oh. This is just like a little group of students. This is like how Facebook started.
Okay, right. Carry on, sorry. Yeah.
So they developed something called Liquiglide, which is a non-toxic, non-stick coating for the inside of ketchup bottles, ensuring that ketchup slides out smoothly, leaving no residue behind.
Ah, so you don't have that little bit left in the bottle where you're shaking it, no. You're wobbling it, you can't get it out
and it's wasted. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've only got one planet. Wow. We've only got one planet.
Yep.
I appreciate that.
No, definitely. So,
but you say we've only got one planet, but then does the liquiglide, whatever it's called, you know, stop it breaking down?
Hopefully
is it
not.
Worse they said for non-toxic. The planet when you try and get rid of the container.
It's non-toxic, non-stick.
Oh, right.
So, and you can go and have a look on their website. It's very tech bro-y. Yeah, it's not really like clear what they actually do. There's a lot of like big buzzwords and stuff, but once you actually get into it, you can find out what they're all about, especially on their About Us page, which had this to say.
We're building a frictionless future. Our mission is to revolutionize products, packaging, processes, and patient experiences by eliminating the friction between solids and liquids.
Interesting, they went with patient experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, what's that about?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if it's like a targeting like health care, like inside of needles, like, oh, God. I don't know.
Yeah, they're all about eliminating the friction between solids and liquids.
Mm.
Getting liquids out of a container.
Mm.
Yeah.
Into a container.
Yeah.
Blood packs.
Blood packs.
For blood transfusions.
Yeah.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to leave any of that behind.
Tubing.
The connoisseurs ketchup is what they call that. Let's finish up on ketchup, shall we? So I wanted to kind of finish our little ketchup journey by, you know, we've already kind of established that ketchup's a super universally loved condiment that is kind of tweaked in all the different cultures around the world. And they've all got kind of their own unique twists and interpretations on it. But some of those kind of interpretations and twists have kind of turned it into something entirely different at times. So I just wanted to go through a few of the kind of countries that I managed to find examples of this and just kind of just expand your palate to the ketchup world, just to finish us off. So
let's see what's out there.
Firstly, we're flying into the Philippines.
Okay.
And we're looking at banana ketchup.
Oh God.
What?
No, thank you.
So in the Philippines, tomato take a backseat and bananas are the star of the show.
Ah.
Which is pretty wild because they're not tangy, really, are they? They're not like...
No.
No.
They're creamy.
Creamy. They were largely introduced during World War II due to a shortage of tomatoes and kind of this sweet and spicy, I'm guessing, from like chilies or whatever they put in it. And kind of tangy version from vinegar and stuff has kind of become a staple in Filipino households.
Wow. Oh, they have it. Oh.
So we're even seeing the effects of World War II there, you know, stopping in tomatoes and then they're kind of forced to use different ingredients. Yeah. And then you've got new things popping up like bloody banana ketchup.
Yeah, there you have. And Filipino chef Margarita Flores loves it so much. Yeah, this to say.
Banana ketchup embodies the Filipino spirit, resourcefulness, resilient, and always ready for a fiesta. And it's bloody brilliant with some crispy fried chicken. Wow. Okay. I mean, crispy fried chicken, jerk chicken, you've kind of got plantain. That's kind of like banana. I don't know. I'm trying to make just some kind of connections, but banana ketchup is fermented and kind of concentrated down. So actually nothing like plantain. So ignore what I just said.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a solution to this because I'm going to be going to this place soon and I'll bring us back some banana ketchup.
Okay.
And we can taste it live on air.
On air.
Yes.
On air.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'll bring the fried chicken.
Okay.
Dom, you bring a Filipino.
Okay.
Andy, you bring the banana ketchup.
Okay.
And we'll have a right little fiesta.
Yeah, I'll find one.
Right, love it. Cool, so that's the Philippines. We've then got Indonesia with something called sambal kecap.
Ooh.
Which, again, kind of takes traditional inspiration from traditional sambal. Indonesians have their own kind of version, which combines the spicy goodness of chili mixed with kind of the sweet depth of like soy sauce based ketchup. Mm. And this commonly referred to as Kit Kat Manis, which is what you were maybe talking about earlier.
Yeah,
about.
That's the one. Yeah. That's it.
So that's Indonesian.
You liar. Ooh. You said it was Thai.
Thought it was Thai.
You big liar.
Yeah, I thought it was Thai.
They all look the same smells.
Oh, no. He's in trouble again.
He's in trouble again.
I've been sexist, racist, everything.
Oh, you pig.
Yeah, no, he's on.
Nah, he's a nice lad. I promise you, he's a nice lad.
But yeah, so it's a balance of sweet, spicy, and umami. Perfect for grilled meats.
Oh,
that in
that's what I normally have it with. My grilled meats.
Outrageous.
A bit closer to home, Netherlands and Belgium. You got something called curry ketchup.
Oh, yeah.
Which curry ketchup.
Imagine we've all had before.
Yeah, a few times.
Yeah, popular with kind of fries, sausages. Curry ketchup is kind of like a thick, sweet and spicy sauce.
All right, cheers, mate.
It's funny you say that, though, mate. Go on.
I was going to say it goes perfectly with fries. That's all I was going to say. Come on, your turn.
No, I was just going to say, my friend Mark, who's Dutch, we went to a Dutch bar once and he ordered some food and it was like a big sausage with almost like a stampot, you know, we covered stampot, the kind of mixed vegetable bubble and squeak-esque thing. But that dish had the sausage on top of that and it had like a curry ketchup on top.
Curry first?
So I think, well, no, it was like a curry ketchup.
Okay.
So I think it's what you were talking about there with this kind of like European version.
Yeah.
Is that nice?
Yeah. It worked really well.
I tried a bite of a stampot. Yeah, okay. Have a nibble in your stampot, lad.
I can't remember. So long ago. Is stampot not soup? Is it not soup-based sausage?
No, stampot is vegetables and like potato, kind of like mashed into.
Okay, fair enough.
Cool.
I was just imagining like some curry ketchup just floating on a bowl of liquid.
Yeah. No, that's not great.
Two different viscosities.
Yeah.
Right. Working against each other. No, but it was nice. It was, it was like a nice sausage, some stampot and some curry ketchup.
Wow.
It's good.
There you go.
There you have it.
The last place I'd like to stop is Japan. And kind of whilst it's not precisely ketchup, it's a very close cousin. And that is tonkatsu. Tonkatsu is kind of like a thick Worcestershire sauce-based sauce, primarily used for kind of like your deep-fried pork cutlets, also known as tonkatsu. Super tangy, super sweet, depth of flavour, and it's got like a blend of kind of like vegetables, fruits and spices in it.
Wow, sounds lovely. A delight.
But yeah, probably one of my favourite dishes, tonkatsu, actually.
Okay.
Went to a place in Kyoto where it was unlimited, you know, the shredded cabbage that you get on the side.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you get a big old tonkatsu with the sauce and stuff and then just keep getting cabbage refills.
I bet your farts smelled lovely the next day.
Oh yeah, horrendous, mate.
Yeah.
Horrendous. Yeah, I must have eaten like four cabbages that day.
Probably got stuck in.
Grilled, loads of grilled meat.
Yeah.
Four cabbages. It was like asking for trouble.
It was like a medieval peasant. None but cabbage that day. Cool. Yeah. So closing thoughts on ketchup. What this journey around the world proves is that ketchup is a canvas. Different countries have painted it with their own cultural brushes, making it an embodiment of their culinary identity. I'd like to end this episode with a cracking quote from Mr. Jay Rayner, who is a food critic, and he sums up the world's favourite condiment quite nicely.
Ketchup is not just a sauce, it's a global phenomenon, a unifier. It bridges cuisines, making us realise we're more connected than we think.
Nice, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's very wholesome.
It's true, though, isn't it?
Very wholesome.
Doesn't matter what kind of food you make, what kind of ingredients you're using, ketchup kind of is that universal thing that from time to time everyone enjoys.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you can kind of get ketchup in the far reaches of the world. Yeah. Similar to like Coca-Cola, it's like, it's just one of those things where it doesn't matter where you are, you're going to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something quite nice about that.
Comforting, you would say.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Ketchup, something that's a staple. It's in our lives. But again, one of those food items that we just don't always know everything about. right under our noses.
Been there
just,
all
just goes to show that sometimes in life you need to just slow down, take a step back and think about what you're doing.
Yeah, just see what you see. Yeah. See what you say. Say what you say.
What is this stuff I put into my mouth all the time?
God.
Yeah.
What is it?
I've been eating this for years. For God's sake.
Cool. Well, there you go. I thoroughly enjoyed that episode.
Yeah, that was good fun, that.
That was really, really insightful. I hope you guys did too. It's nice to be back to making episodes regularly, isn't it? We're back in the swing of things now and it's feeling good.
Yeah.
Having a good time.
100%.
Learning more about food. We need to cover a drink. I've had the word drink in my intro for quite a while, and we've not covered one yet.
Okay.
Okay.
So maybe there's a drink on the way.
What's your favourite beverage, Miles?
Ah, pina colada.
I knew you were going to say pina colada.
I knew you were going to say it.
All right, look at him.
No. Yeah, we'll have a think on that. It's maybe a drink at some point. I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as we did making it. And yeah, if you're enjoying the podcast, please consider rating us. You can rate on Spotify or wherever else you're listening to the podcast. Those ratings really, really help, and they'll help to make us show up on people's feeds, and it might get more people listening, and that would be awesome. Yeah.
Our day jobs. Do us full time.
Oh, yeah.
Us talking in your ear. 24/7.
That's it.
I mean, these episodes are out every other Monday, but it'd be nice to work to a point where we could be releasing them weekly, perhaps. So the more you guys can help by sharing the good word of the Lord, the better chances of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, if you want to recommend a dish or you even just want to reach out and chat to us, you can send us an email at whatthefoodpodcast@gmail.com and we can have a chin wag over there. And I think that is it.
Yeah.
We'll see you on the flip side. We'll see you in 2 weeks from now. Stay safe and see you soon.
Ciao.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.